Thanks for inviting me into your home, long-haul truck, RV, camper, taxi, your parents' well-appointed rec room, with the simulated wood paneling, electric fireplace, and the painting of dogs playing poker, your loft, that greasy spoon just off the interstate, and your cabin in the woods. Welcome to Coast AM, the best in late-night radio. I'm Richard Serrett, and tonight this morning, we're coming to you live from my little studio beneath the stairs in Old Thornhill, just north of Toronto. I've been sitting in this studio for a couple of hours following the news, watching the horrifying videos showing NYPD officers clashing with protesters in Manhattan with shields and batons, where they arrested some stragglers. In Washington, D.C., the historic St. John's Church, 205 years old, was set on fire. At Lafayette Park in front of the White House, protesters set an American flag on fire. Hundreds of protests have unfolded in at least 75 cities after the horrific death of George Floyd, a 46-year-old black man in Minneapolis, at the hands of a white policeman. At least 40 cities have imposed curfews in light of the riots and violence, and National Guard members have been activated in 15 states and Washington, D.C. Looting has also begun in Montreal. There was an incident up here in Toronto as well. A young woman, 29-year-old Regis Korchinski-Paquette, who died after falling from a balcony while police were on the scene investigating a domestic dispute call. There have been allegations, unproven as yet, that she was pushed by police. Again, unproven. But there is an investigation, and there have been protests in Canada, mostly peaceful. I hope wherever you are, you're safe and sound, and may God have mercy on us all. But I'm not going to talk about any of that tonight, this morning. I hope you agree. We can all use a break. I'm hoping you came to Coast AM for a little escapism. Think of this as your escape room. You're safe in here. I think my producer, Chris Burrows, and I have managed to serve up just that, the kind of good goods that you've come to expect from Coast to Coast, some thrills, some chills, and a little history thrown in for good measure. William Mann is a 32nd degree Mason and an officer of the Knights Templar. You know, the Catholic military order formed in the 12th century and charged with safeguarding pilgrims to the Holy Land, who, according to legend, amassed an unimaginable fortune, managed to raise the ire of the Vatican and a number of Catholic kings in Europe, were hunted down, executed, some escaped, with their treasure, possibly to North America. Yes, those Knights Templar, apparently, they still exist. And Bill Mann's new book, The Last Refuge of the Knights Templar, while a piece of fiction, is based on actual correspondence between two famous, or perhaps infamous, 19th century Masonic leaders. Elbert Pike, arguably the most powerful and influential Mason in America, and his Canadian counterpart, Colonel J.W.B. MacLeod Mor. Not only did Bill Mann uncover the cache of letters, but he weaved them into a brilliant thriller. Imagine The Da Vinci Code meets National Treasure. We're not going to give too much of the book away, but instead, we'll focus on the actual life of aforementioned Elbert Pike, a mountain of a man, author, poet, orator, jurist, and prominent member of the Freemasons. He was also a senior officer of the Confederate States Army, who commanded the District of Indian Territory in the Trans-Mississippi Theater of the American Civil War. Pike also authored the most important book on Freemasonry, Morals and Dogma. He's been accused of being a Luciferian. He may have been involved in the plot to assassinate President Lincoln. He was pro-slavery, but considered a great ally of the American Indian. Who was Elbert Pike? With author, 32nd degree Mason, Bill Mann. Coming up in the second half of the program, Nathaniel Gillis is a religious demonologist and author, and after living in a haunted house for 20 years researching what it was he encountered, he's sought to redefine the nature of haunting phenomena, ghosts, and high strangeness. He'll discuss his encounters with unclean spirits, discarnate entities, incubi and succubi, and demons, and why he believes they, the demons, bear little resemblance to the horned devils we learned about in Sunday school. From Masons to demons. Well, I never said we were going to talk about unicorns and rainbows, did I? Welcome to the Audio Imaginarium. Come on in, weary traveler, hang your cloak on a peg, grab a stool, and come gather around the fire. There are stories to be told, and you are among friends. I'm Richard Serrett, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Why don't you stay a while? William F. Mann is an officer of the Knights Templar of Canada's Grand Executive Committee, a member of its Grand Council, and serves as the Sovereign Great Priory's Grand Archivist. He's also a 32nd degree Scottish Rite Mason, being a member of the Merton Lodge of Perfection, Hamilton Sovereign Chapter of Rosecroix, and Moore Sovereign Consistory, Hamilton. William is also a past preceptor of Godfrey de Bouillon Preceptory, No. 3, Hamilton District, No. 2 of the United Religious and Military Orders of St. John's of Jerusalem, Palestine, Rhodes, and Malta, of the Order of the Temple, Knights Templar of Canada, Templar Sanctuaries in North America, the Templar Meridians, the Knights Templar in the New World, the 13th Pillar, are just several of his books. His latest is called The Last Refuge of the Knights Templar. William F. Mann, welcome back to Coast AM. How are you?
Good. Thanks very much, Richard. How are you?
I hope I wasn't interrupting your plans for... I'm terrific. I hope I was. I wasn't interrupting your plans for world domination. Do you get
no,
that a lot? Do people say, "Oh, the Masons, you're plot"?
Well, you know what? It's unfortunately watching what's happening around the world, and specifically in North America, it's saddening tonight.
Absolutely, yes. A lot of people might be surprised, and I'd have to count myself as one of them, that the Knights Templar are still around. We, as I mentioned in my introduction, we think of the Knights Templar as guarding the, or safeguarding the pilgrims to the Holy Land. They were created in the 12th century. They seem to have sort of vanished. And here you are, a member of the Knights Templar of Canada.
Absolutely.
The fact that you're still around, you know, is amazing.
It's one of those situations where Masonry has always been secretive. We don't pertain to too many secrets, but we've always been secretive. So for over 1,000 years, yes, there's been this continuous history of Knights Templar and Freemasonry.
And what is the difference between a Mason and a Knights Templar?
Well, a Knights Templar, in this case, in my case, it's known as a Christian Masonry. It's the highest level of Freemasonry on the York Rite side, on the English side. In Scottish Rite Masonry, it's one of the highest degrees within the 32 degrees of Scottish Rite Masonry. So it really meets at the top of the pyramid, if, per se, if you'd like.
So... The Last Refuge of the Knights Templar is a work of fiction, but Albert Pike, and we'll talk about his life here in a moment, is such a larger-than-life character. Some might say he's somewhat notorious, controversial. He's such an amazing character, though. Did you give any consideration to writing this book as a piece of nonfiction, just because, I mean, the story of uncovering the letters and so forth, it's such a thriller all on its own. Why the need to fictionalize?
Well, unfortunately, as you see, especially in America, even tonight, there's certain facets of the right-wing politics, the neo-fascists, the neo-Nazis that... they consider wrongly that Albert Pike is almost a demigod to them, that they see themselves or emulating the earlier Albert Pike in terms of the nefarious ways that Pike went about things.
All right, so let's talk about Albert Pike, his early life, because obviously, you know, a brilliant mind. How old was he when he was accepted into Harvard? Was he something like 13 or 14?
He was 16, and he was self-taught. Actually, they say he was self-taught, but he was guided by the Jesuits, which is very interesting in itself, because the Jesuits have had a hand in his career and had a sort of a guiding hand in his whole lifetime of education and spirituality.
But he couldn't afford to go to Harvard, I understand. So where did he end up going?
Well, he was actually accepted into Harvard. He didn't end up going, but he was self-taught and wrote the bar exam for Arkansas on his own, and which is amazing when you think about it, even at that time in the 1840s. And from that, he developed an amazing career as both a lawyer and, as you indicated, a Confederate soldier and then a politician, and then behind the scenes, he came to the forefront as the lifelong sovereign grand commander of the Scottish Rite of the Southern Jurisdiction of the United States.
But before that, he was a kind of an outdoorsman as well, loved to, I believe, hunt and fish. There was there's a legendary story of him traveling from, I believe it's Arkansas, to Taos, New Mexico. Tell us what happened along the way.
Well, just after the start of his journey, his horse up and died. And most people would have quit and gone home, but Albert Pike, for some reason, took it upon himself to travel the 1,500 miles by foot, which really gives you an indication in terms of the self-determination, the inner spirituality of the character of the man, in order to have that determination to really complete that journey. And his whole life was a lifelong journey of learning. He taught himself how to speak 15 different languages. Probably 7, 8 of them are now extinct. And over time, over a period of over 30 years, he wrote numerous books, probably one of the most famous of them being Morals and Dogma of the Scottish Rite Freemasonry, and that book is actually given to any Scottish Rite Freemason in the Southern Jurisdiction, which has gone through 32 degrees over 150 years.
And he came back to Arkansas. I believe he started, was it a newspaper that he started after marrying? She was a descendant of the Alexander Hamilton, I think.
Yes. He wasn't a stupid man, per se. He married into money, and it held him in good stead throughout his lifetime.
And was he raised a Christian? What was his religious background?
He wasn't an atheist, but he was one of those that believed that right from the start that he could converse with God in a different manner, in a direct manner. He was raised by the Jesuits, but he never did become a Roman Catholic. So it's interesting in itself, even from an earlier age, he took it upon himself to understand God on an individual level, something that most people haven't done over a lifetime.
And how did he, or how was he introduced to Freemasonry?
He was introduced very, very innocently. He became an Odd Fellow, first of all, and the Odd Fellows still exist, but there aren't many lodges around nowadays. But he became an Odd Fellow, and through that, there was an appeal of Freemasonry, especially in the southern states. The southern states was such at that time a hotbed of Freemasonry, and he was introduced by some very influential people.
And I mean, he seemed to be a conflicted man, because on the one hand, he was pro-slavery, right?
He was pro-slavery, but on the other hand, he was supportive of North American Indian throughout his lifetime, which, as you indicated, is a real conflict. His belief was that the independent states really had the decision in terms of whether to be pro-slavery or not. He was against federalism, and that's how he found himself ending up joining and fighting the Confederate Confederate cause during the Civil War.
Was he a slave owner himself?
He wasn't a slave owner himself. Earlier in life, obviously, he didn't have the wherewithal, the means to own slaves at that time. But he promoted the ownership of slaves. He saw that as the only way that the Southern states would be able to continue on an economically viable basis to compete against the Northern industry.
And then, as you say, on the other hand, he had an affinity for North American Indians, and he argued on their behalf as a lawyer, I think, all the way to the Supreme Court. Tell me about that case.
Yeah, he actually, following the Civil War, he argued on behalf of the North American Indians, in particular the Cherokee and the Choctaw, and for their land rights, and he actually won the case at the federal high court. But unfortunately, the North American Indian, the Cherokees, were never able to acknowledge what they had won during that federal case.
And why was he considered such a friend? I mean, obviously because he fought for them in the courts, but where did that come from, his interest in the North American Indian, their culture, their
life?
Why was he such a friend?
He'd been introduced to the North American Indian rather early in life. And through his travels and endeavors through what's known as the Indian Territory, Oklahoma, and other southern states. And he obviously developed an affinity towards the North American Indians, recognizing in many ways he was introduced, he was trusted, and introduced into numbers of secret societies of the North American Indian, including the main secret society of the Algonquin Nation, known as the Madewin. And the Madewin, in actual fact, due to this notion that the Knights Templar arrived in North America in pre-Columbian times and strategically intermarried with the Algonquin Nation, the Madewin reflected the Knights Templar ritual, and he recognized this on a very early stage, to the point that he was initiated into the Madewin. And it was through that he was able to encourage a number of the Algonquin nations to fight for the Confederates during the Civil War.
So he was well versed in this legend of the Knights Templar having come to North America. So
absolutely, and I think that he recognized through the myths and legends and other notions, signs, seals, tokens of the North American Indians, that in fact it was proof that the Knights Templar actually did arrive in North America in the 12th, 13th, and 14th century.
Did the Algonquins, for example, confirm that to him, that yes, this is true?
Well, you have to understand a little bit about my background, whereas my father's side of my background is very English and very military oriented, and that's where I get the Masonic relationships. But on my mother's side, my mother is full-blooded Algonquin, and it's through family members, through my association with both sides, that it's been proven that in actual fact there have been these marriages, intermarriages. And my mother and father are proof of that over 400 years since the arrival of the Knights Templar in North America.
We have about 2 minutes here before the break. I just wanted to get started on this, and we'll continue after the break. And that is his career in the Confederate Army. How did that begin?
Well, it was interesting. because of his association with North American Indians, obviously the Confederates realized there was real potential to draw the Indians into the conflict on the southern side. And it was through Albert Pike that they were able to do that. So he was actually appointed a brigadier general in the Confederate Army. And his
statue... Right. Sorry, Bill, for the interruption. We're going to take a time out, come back, and we'll pick up on that point. Albert Pike and William Mann, my guest, the author of The Last Refuge of the Knights Templar. In case you missed it, the SpaceX and NASA launch on Saturday afternoon, you can see the video in the carousel up at coasttocoastam.com. And our webmaster tonight, Lex Lonehood, has posted that and other tantalizing tidbits. The successful launch of the American crew aboard a Falcon 9 rocket was the first mission from the Kennedy Space Center to put people into space for almost 10 years. Since the end of the space shuttle program, the launch was also historic for SpaceX as it became the first private company to carry humans into orbit. The Dragon capsule docked Sunday morning with the International Space Station. The astronauts will stay in space for at least 6 weeks, but possibly for up to 4 months. And again, you can watch the launch, in case you missed it, in the highlight carousel up at coasttocoastam.com. More of my conversation with William F. Mann as we talk about the life of America's most powerful Mason, Albert Pike, right here on Coast to Coast AM. We are back with Bill Mann, the author of Last Refuge of the Knights Templar. And Bill, before the break, we were talking about Albert Pike. He was commissioned as, I believe you said, a brigadier general in the Confederate Army, commanded in the Indian Territory. When did he run afoul of the Confederates? Because
like anything else, he couldn't control the native battalions. And there was a famous battle, Battle of Pea Ridge, where the natives overran the Union Army to the point that they started scalping all the Union soldiers, and this horrified even the Southern Confederacy. And then they wanted the Native battalions to become part of the regular Southern Confederacy Army and to fight outside the Indian Territory. And the agreement with between Pike and the Natives was that this wouldn't happen. And so that's where he ran afoul. And he was actually charged with treason by the Southern Confederacy and hid out in the Arkansas backwoods until he essentially got the charges dropped.
And then after the end of the Civil War, he was being hunted down by the Union as well, right?
Well, this is the most fascinating thing. He was hunted down by the Union because he was in fact. Linked to the, or potentially linked to the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. So he fled. He fled across the states and ended up in Ottawa, Canada for 3 months until he miraculously, very interesting, received a pardon by then President Andrew Johnson.
Now, the Knights of the Golden Circle, that was the secret society that was involved in the plot to assassinate Lincoln, not once, but twice. Of course, the first time failed, the second time was successful. Can he be tied to the Knights of the Golden Circle? Is there a paper trail?
Well, there's not actually a paper trail. There's a lot of speculation that he was, in actual fact, part of the Knights of the Golden Circle, but he can be tied directly to the Ku Klux Klan. He was a Grand Dragon of Arkansas, and he actually wrote the rituals of the Ku Klux Klan. Of course, the Ku Klux Klan, for any historian, its basis, its formation was a little different than what it had evolved into. So Albert Pike, on one hand, could be seen as an absolute criminal, but on the other hand, he could be seen as just supporting the rights of the southern states, even after the collapse, their collapse after the Civil War.
And how does, I mean, he was a, as I mentioned earlier, a mountain of a man. I think he was like 6 foot something, 300 pounds, hair down to his shoulders. How does a someone like that escape into Canada undetected?
Well, I think when you say undetected, I think it's obvious from any of the research that I've done that he had the help of many Masons. He was regarded at that time as one of the highest ranking Masons in North America. And it was through the help of his counterpart in Canada at the time, British North America, Colonel William James Bury MacLeod Mohr, who really was instrumental in bringing Knights Templarism along with Scottish Rite Masonry and Rosicrucianism to North America.
So let's talk about his Canadian counterpart, Colonel J.W.B. MacLeod Mohr, you just mentioned,
yes.
Who helped and aided and abetted Albert Pike. And these two would go on to correspond, and we'll talk about their letters in a moment. But who was he?
William James Bury MacLeod Mohr was your atypical British colonel in the British Army. He was born in Ireland. He was initiated in the Freemasonry at the age of 18, became a career British Army officer, and when he was stationed on the Isle of Malta, he reintroduced Knights Templarism to the Isle of Malta. So he was very well regarded within the areas of Freemasonry, but above all, he was a British colonel. So if you compare Albert Pike, who was this gigantic, sort of gregarious, almost Santa Claus-like figure with long flowing beard and long flowing hair, and MacLeod Mohr, who's this rigid British Army officer, you couldn't have two different men, even if you tried.
And at what point did the two men start to correspond?
They started to correspond really 1867, and their correspondence continued to right to the point of MacLeod Mohr's death in 1890, and Albert Pike followed them not a year later in 1891. So there was over 30 years of correspondence altogether.
And how many letters in total, do you know?
33 letters, which is actually interesting considering there's, if you include the honorary degree of 33 associated with Scottish Rite Freemasonry, this was not by coincidence. I think Albert Pike actually controlled it and worked it that way so that they were 33 letters altogether.
And tell us how you uncovered these letters. I mean, this has to be for Masons like the find of the century. How did you uncover them?
Well, just very innocently, about 6 years ago, I was appointed Grand Archivist, Grand Historian for the Sovereign Great Priory of Canada. And in that, I inherited the guardianship of a number of artifacts, relics, clothing, jewels, and a whole series of files. And in those file boxes, unbeknownst to me, and I don't think unbeknownst to anybody else because they were covered in dust, there was this file folder, very innocent, and I went through them, and it took me a few reads to realize the significance of these letters, and had them authenticated by the Grand Historian, Grand Archivist in Washington, D.C., that they were, in fact, letters from Albert Pike to MacLeod Mohr, which MacLeod Mohr had actually collected and saved.
And what was your reaction when you realized what you were holding in your hands?
Well, you can imagine my reaction. I almost fell to the floor. But it took me a while to understand. I laid out the letters. You have to understand a lot of them were almost disintegrating due to their poor condition. And as I read them, I realized that they were written in certain levels, unbeknownst to just the regular reader. But given my 25 years of Freemasonry and my involvement in another number of orders and bodies, I realized that there were hidden levels of coded messages within the letters themselves.
Without giving the book away, obviously, but can you give me an example and how you were able to decipher these layers of codes and encryption?
Well, the main premise of the book, my book, is that there's a sacred vault. A sacred vault's been established by the medieval Knights Templar in North America, and in that they collected all of the Templar treasure, which had disseminated after its initial discovery under the rules of the Temple of Jerusalem, and that Knights Templar collected these sacred relics, documents, and other artifacts, and culminated in the sacred vault in Western North America. And that depository is to be used for the establishment of a new Jerusalem and a rebuilding of the Temple of Solomon at the appropriate time.
So these letters confirm that the Templar treasure, whatever that might be, whether it's gold or silver or knowledge, whatever it is, these letters confirm that it was brought to North America for safekeeping.
Yes, and that's the most amazing thing to high-ranking Freemason Knights Templar such as myself, but also to be disseminated really very quietly to the public. This is an amazing revelation, and again, coming full circle, at the start of the show, you talked about why I felt compelled to incorporate it within a fictional story. And as I indicated, there's certain people, there's certain societies that would probably kill to get their hands on the, as you say, the knowledge, the relics, and the physical treasure that lies there to this day.
So, I mean, this is a real-life national treasure. I mean, we've seen the movie with Nicolas Cage. It has elements of that in it, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And but you could say what fact was the movie National Treasure based on? And there were certain facts there. And it spoke of the Templar treasure, which actually made its way to North America. And it... in the case of the movie, it was within a pit, but really the idea is the same, that there's a sacred vault which lies somewhere in North America.
How long did it take you to break the code?
It probably took me, as I say, a lifetime of learning and knowledge and understanding, but it probably took me about a year.
And... once you broke that code and realized this is proof that the Templar treasure is here in North America, I mean, who do you run to tell that to? As you say, this could put your life in jeopardy.
Yes, and I do, and I want anybody listening out there to know that I don't have the letters. In my possession, they've been secreted away in terms of their safety. But that's the big question: is if I recover the Templar treasure, and that's another question. Who does it belong to? And obviously, there's going to be certain groups ranging from the Vatican to the American government, which are going to lay claim to this treasure.
All right, so we should go back a little bit to the, I guess the demise, if I can use that word, of the Knights Templar in Europe after they had amassed this treasure, and we will, it maybe going into the next hour, or after the top of the hour, we'll discuss what that treasure might be. So, the How did they run afoul of the Vatican and a number of Catholic dynasties in Europe?
Well, they ran afoul of both the Catholic Church and the French royalty, King Philippe the Fourth. It was on a Friday evening, October the 13th, 1307, that there was this like SWAT team movement across Europe that the King of France had orchestrated with the support of the Vatican. But luckily, the Temple Treasure had been spirited away out of France even before then, because the Knights Templar possessed essentially the greatest counter-espionage unit at the time across North America and the old world, Europe. So they ran afoul because they had lent enormous sums of money to both the Vatican and the French court. And obviously the French court specifically wasn't able to pay it back. So they created a number of fallacies, number of lies aimed towards the Knights Templar in order to justify their obliteration. But when you talk about their demise, it never really happened. There were a certain number of people, including the Grand Master at the time, Jacques de Molay, who gave themselves up in order to provide time for the treasure to be spirited out of France.
And how many Knights Templar were there at the height of this order?
Well, at the height of the order, essentially you have to understand that it was the Knights Templar who really orchestrated, along with certain Cistercian monks, the Crusades, the first through the seven Crusades. In essence, there were tens of thousands of Knights Templar and their supporting squires and army. At the height of the time, most of the French nobility provided one or more sons to become Knights Templar on their holy crusades.
And after the crackdown in Europe, and they fled, how many do you believe fled to North America?
Well, in essence, the Knights Templar were very strategic. They believed that not to put their eggs all in one basket. There were groups of Templars that fled to Denmark, fled to Scotland, fled to England, fled to Portugal. I would say that there were at least 500 Knights Templar that fled directly to North America. And as I say, settled and intermarried with the North American Indian.
All right. When we come back, we'll discuss a little bit about what that treasure might be, and maybe even where it is. And we'll also discuss the premise of Last Refuge of the Knights Templar with William Mann. We'll also open up the phone lines and take questions and comments.